The second case for oral argument this morning is Tammy Jean Kovacnica, Appellant versus the State of South Dakota, Appellee. For the appellant, we have Ms. Nicole Laughlin, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the state, we have Ms. Ann Meyer, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Ms. Laughlin, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Nicole Laughlin. I'm here today representing the appellant in this matter, Tammy Jean Kovacnica. The facts of this case are simple and undisputed. My client, Tammy Kovacnica, was intoxicated and drove the wrong way down the interstate. This resulted in her crashing into a car with five young men in it, severely injuring one of the young men and killing another. We are here today because the state was allowed to inflame the jury by making it clear that Kovacnica had multiple DUI convictions and by introducing testimony that replaced my client's car with the image of 902 guns being pointed at the victims. That is where I'd like to start with issue two in this case. The trial court erred in allowing Officer Crozier's testimony related to kinetic energy in this case. At the trial, the state called Officer Brian Crozier to testify. Crozier has testified in accident reconstruction. At the trial, he used a formula for kinetic energy and plugged in an estimated weight and speed of Kovacnica's car to figure out the estimated force of her vehicle. He then took the numbers that he got from Wikipedia related to muzzle energy force of a .40 caliber Glock handgun and plugged those numbers into the formula to make a comparison for the jury.
Is there evidence in the record that he used the information from Wikipedia to estimate the muzzle energy?
Well, Justice Wilbur, I did include in the reply brief the interaction between he and defense counsel that took place off of the record, where I think that it is clear that he states that the muzzle energy information came from Wikipedia. I don't think that the muzzle energy off of a gun is common knowledge to a police officer. Certainly, I don't think that it's part of their training, and he never testified that it was part of their training to know what that speed muzzle energy was that you would need for that kinetic energy formula.
It is, that's factual information. However, is there a dispute as to the accuracy of the facts, no matter where it comes from?
Well, I think that the problem here is that it's not reliable information.
Well, was there anything to show that it wasn't reliable information? That's the question.
Well, there was no expert on the defense side coming in to dispute the numbers, if that's what you're asking. No, there was not. But as I stated, our position is that it's unreliable information, and Daubert requires that the information have a reliable foundation.
Is your concern here the fact that they're attempting to use something as an example, or the fact that the example happens to be a gun? I mean, what if it had been, say, a Major League Baseball player throwing a baseball at a certain velocity? Would that have been prejudicial, or just because it happens to be a gun?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the major problem we have here is that it's not just a gun, it's 902 guns pointed at the victims in this case. I mean, that's what the officer testified to. He did testify that he could have plugged in any innocuous item. He could have used golf balls, baseballs, tennis shoes, teddy bears. He didn't. He used Glock handguns. The state in this case had the burden of showing that the vehicle was being used as a deadly weapon. You can't just take the item you're seeking to prove as a deadly weapon and replace it with something that is obviously a deadly weapon in the eyes of the jury. And that's exactly what they did by the use of this example. It was highly prejudicial, and it persuaded by illegitimate means.
Are you contesting the formula itself?
The kinetic energy formula?
Yes.
I think that, you know, the officer was trained as an accident reconstruction expert. If he was coming in to reconstruct the accident and use his kinetic energy formula that he had in his handbook from the academy, I don't think anyone would have had a problem with that. It's that we're pulling numbers for these examples, these hypotheticals, from Wikipedia, plugging them in, and then coming in and offering that as reliable testimony.
Was there a Daubert hearing where this, where the reliability of this testimony was tested?
Well, I think from the record it's obvious that defense counsel was taken off guard at trial, that this information was coming in like this. I'm not going to say that it was as pretty of a Daubert hearing as we would like to see on the record, but I think that the objections that were entered and the hearing that was outside of the presence of the jury brought up the issues of Daubert. Whether it was an official Daubert hearing or anyone called it that at the time, I can't say that.
See, as I understand, this officer at Crozier was not able to do an accident reconstruction because of the fact that the angle of the cars when they collided. Is that right?
Correct. He had nothing to do with this case. He comes in after the fact. The state calls him up. It's in the record that the state calls him up and says, hey, I need to prove that this vehicle was being used as a deadly weapon. Can you come up with some sort of a comparison for me? And that's when he and his friend, his co-officer, thought, hey, let's use this handgun comparison.
Did the jury conclude that she was using the vehicle as a deadly weapon?
They did. They did find her guilty of that count. I would argue to the court, though, that not only was it extremely prejudicial, it was irrelevant. To prove that the vehicle was being used as a deadly weapon, the state had to show that the use of the automobile was of such a nature that death or serious bodily harm was a probable result. Nobody was disputing that this was a forceful accident. No one was disputing that the result of it was deadly. What the jury had to think about and had to consider was whether the facts of the case made this result probable or not. And I don't think that the force of the vehicle was an element for them to consider here. And to be relevant, you have to be able to show the jury something more than they can infer for themselves. The jury could infer very easily this was a deadly accident. Somebody died, and nobody was disputing that Tammy Kovasnica was the person who caused the death in this case. Even if the evidence is relevant, it must be excluded if the probative value is outweighed by the prejudice to the defendant. In the record here, we never see a weighing by the trial court of prejudice versus probative value of the evidence. What we see here is the trial court saying that the officer has clearly articulated a basis for his testimony. That's not the standard. The standard is it prejudicial? Is it going to result in undue prejudice to the defendant? And is it reliable? And we spoke a little bit about that reliable foundation that is required by Daubert. Here the trial court let the information come in even after learning that it came from Wikipedia. And as we've stated, Wikipedia is not a reliable source. Anyone can put whatever information they want to at any time. The comparison of my client's vehicle to 902 40 caliber Glock pistols pointed at the victims in this case, was so inflammatory that it distracted the jury from what their job was. And for that reason, it was inadmissibly prejudicial.
At what point in the trial did this comment, or was it made?
It was late in the trial, Your Honor. Defense counsel had a difficult job in this case. They came in saying, our client did this. We know that she did this. We're not here to prove that she's not guilty. We're here to prove that this is vehicular homicide, not manslaughter in the first degree. So there's not a lot of transcript in this case. I want to say that Officer Crozier comes right before the state is about to rest.
But this isn't something that just pops up then in the final argument or something like that, because we've had concerns with comments in final argument that cannot be rebutted in previous cases, but apparently you had the opportunity at least to rebut it at some point after it was said.
Yes, Your Honor. somewhat. If you review the record, you'll see that trial counsel doesn't vigorously defend against the or bring up the comparison. But as any trial counsel knows, if a bomb is dropped in the middle of your trial, you don't go to the jury, look at the bomb, look at the bomb, look at the bomb. So I think that he did the best that he could. They got the jury out of there as soon as he understood what was going on. They had the questioning off the record so they could clearly understand what the testimony was going to be and what it was going to be used for. And the trial court let it in. He cross-examined to the best of his ability and then, you know, was on to final argument from there. But there was no defense expert that was called in to rebut any of this testimony.
Thank you.
And again, nobody's arguing that it wasn't forceful. It was forceful. It killed somebody. It was a horrible situation. But there's a big difference between manslaughter in the first degree, which is a Class C felony, where Ms. Kvasnik is looking at life, and vehicular homicide, which is a Class 3 felony, where she's looking at 15 years. So, you know, defense counsel had a fight in front of him, but he deserved a fair fight in this case. And by the introduction of that testimony, it didn't become a fair fight. Kvasnikova was also prejudiced by the language used in counts 1 and 2 of the indictment, which brings us to the next issue, which is listed as Issue 1 in the briefs. The language during the commission of a felony under SDCL 22-16-15 sub 1 is impermissibly prejudicial when referring to the crime of driving under the influence. The first two counts of this indictment were charged out as manslaughter in the first degree, stating that homicide is manslaughter in the first degree if perpetrated without any design to affect death while engaged in the commission of any felony. The underlying felony alleged by the state here is DUI. The problem is that DUI is not a felony. A DUI is a misdemeanor until and unless the Part 2 information can be proven later. Prior convictions cannot be introduced into evidence in the trial of the primary charge. So whether a DUI is a first offense or a tenth offense has absolutely no bearing on the elements of the crime of DUI itself. Prior DUI convictions are only material in regard to the penalty. What the trial court did here was allow the DUI to be the underlying felony and allowed the jury to consider those counts. Now, as the state argued in their brief, and I'm sure will argue before the court today, she was acquitted on those two counts, count one and count two, which were charged under this homicide during the commission of the felony language. But that does not render this point moot. The acquittal on these two counts does not negate the prejudice that tainted the verdict on the rest of the counts. The jury.
What should have been done here, then, in your opinion? Should there have been a severance of the charges, two separate trials, or how do you deal with this?
I think that DUI is not a suitable underlying felony. The crime of DUI is not a felony.
So there's no way, in your opinion, the state could have gotten this type of a charge to the jury?
They shouldn't have been able to.
All right.
No.
How did the court instruct the jury then? When the court listed the essential elements that had the state had to prove in that count, wasn't felony an essential element?
Exactly, Your Honor.
And so what did the court say, that they had to prove a DUI in order to establish a felony?
I believe that the court just said, you must find that this happened in the course of the commission of a felony and left it blank. I could be wrong, but...
Well, if that's the way it was, I mean, there would be no way for the jury to convict him of that. I mean, there was no way to find beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed a felony because there was no felony alleged there except a misdemeanor DUI. That's what you're saying.
And that's our argument, Your Honor. The DUI should not have been the basis for the crime, for the manslaughter in the first degree in the first two counts of the indictment, because it's not a felony. Even the trial court admitted when she allowed the DUI to be used in this language, because this came up as a motion to dismiss pretrial. The defense filed a motion to dismiss on the first two counts because of this, because of the fact that the DUI is a misdemeanor. And the judge even admitted in her opinion or on the record that if counts one and count two were guilty, and later there was a problem with the Part 2 information on the DUI, she would have to go back and vacate those two guilty verdicts. So what she's doing is allowing two very serious charges, again, Class C felonies, life in prison, to go forward, knowing that if the second part is not proven later after trial, that those are going to be vacated. It just doesn't work like that.
Well, if we assume, I should say if we decide that third offense DUI is a felony for purposes of this statute, then the judge did the only, Judge Homan did the only thing, Homan did the only thing she could do. And that is say that she would dismiss if it wasn't found to be a third offense.
Well, Your Honor, I think that it's nonsensical to allow the felony that predicates the offense to have to be proven later to be an actual felony. It just doesn't make logical sense. And that's where our point of view comes from here. Not only does it not make sense, as I said, though, she was acquitted on these two charges, and that's why I didn't come straight at the court on the motion to dismiss saying these should have been dismissed, because they were acquitted. But she was prejudiced by the fact that the jury contemplated that DUI as being a felony. And we know that they did, because we see them come back with questions, and they're confused. Is killing someone while you're drunk a felony DUI? What constitutes a felony? Those questions are in the record. I encourage you to go back and look at them, because it shows the confusion. And I'm not asking, as Appellee suggests, for the court to go back and hypothecate as to what the jurors are thinking or what their deliberations are. I'm asking you to go back and see the confusion that's apparent in the record.
Did the court define felony in the instructions?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Did the court define the term felony in the instructions?
I'm just not confident enough in my recollection right now of the instructions to give you a yes or no answer on that. I believe that the court recognized, as State v. Bacon tells us, that, you know, prior DUI convictions can't come in. So I think that it just said felony. But again, I don't recollect right now. But it was clear that the jury understood that the DUI was the felony. It's clear. And when they have this understanding that that's the felony that's being contemplated, it's common knowledge that a first DUI is not a felony. It's common knowledge to the public that you do not go to prison the first time you get a DUI. So they are now imputed with the knowledge that Ms. Kovacnica has multiple DUIs. Not just multiple DUIs, but enough to make this DUI a felony, which is extremely prejudicial. And when you take the cumulative effect and you look at this through the lens of the prejudice that's going on here, the state was able to take what is very clean cut, my client is intoxicated, driving down the interstate the wrong way, and killed someone. Those are horrid facts in and of themselves. They're able to shape those and say, this multiple DUI offender was barreling down the interstate at the force of 902 40 Glock handguns pointed at these victims. It's not fair. And it's not just me that says it's not fair. It's the Constitution that says that Ms. Kovacnica had the right to have a fair trial. She was unduly prejudiced in this case. The prejudice was cumulative, and we would ask this court to reverse and remand for a new trial. If there are no further questions, I'm finished.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Laughlin. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. I don't think that the state's reading the record the same way the defense is reading it. My reading of the record on behalf of the state is that the formulas in this case, and we see that at 275 of the record, during the in-chambers questioning of the officer, they come from a police manual, which is something that the officer used as a resource tool. They're from the Northern University of Florida. What he did was he contacted some people who worked in accident reconstruction who were engineers. He talked to them. He uses a manual. The Wikipedia is separate. The Wikipedia, and it's the last four pages of the court's exhibit two or exhibit one, which didn't go to the jury, and it says Wikipedia on the bottom of the exhibit. That came from Wikipedia. That information was not what Crozier used at trial. What he's using at trial, that was provided to him by another officer. And this didn't go to the jury. What he's plugging into these formulas are his standard knowledge from being a accident reconstructionist. That's his background. That's his training. He trained in advanced classes in peer to other law enforcement officers. He's also taught at Southwestern Tech. So the cases that we cited in our second issue, they do indicate, there's quite a few cases out there in Wikipedia, and a lot of it is on judicial opinions using Wikipedia for definitional purposes. It's an open encyclopedia that people on the internet can edit as they want to. And what the case law is saying is that it may or may not be reliable, but it's not the pivotal or defining thing in this case because the officer is testifying from his experience and knowledge. And that includes his knowledge about Glock pistols. He's carried one for a long time. He's got one on his hip when he's sitting there on the stand.
But isn't the issue not the formula itself, which I, from my reading, came from the manuals, but the force velocity, which he wouldn't know from carrying a pistol on his hip? Isn't that the issue?
Well, he had
the
to
force
do the
velocity that's plugged into the formula?
That's a good question. He had to do the computation, and he had to put the formula together because he said he didn't carry that particular one in his head. You know, he had to plug that in. But the trial court looked at it from the perspective that this was a comparison tool that gave the jury, which is looking at an everyday object, no matter what anybody says. We don't realize. It's shocking to me to read that you get so many feet per minute when a car is coming at you and you cover so much ground. For the jury that has to translate what happened that night on the interstate to manslaughter in the first degree with a dangerous weapon, it gives them an idea of the force that's associated with this dangerous weapon, which is essentially the victim's car. And Justice Kohnkamp made a really interesting point because this case is different, not like Stetter and not like Siegschlag, because we don't know the speed of the victim's vehicle in this case. There was no accident report. They couldn't put an accident report together, and that was Crozier who was looking at putting that together because of the side impact. So we don't have a speed that we can automatically plug into this and say, wow, that really works. So what they did, and the court said that this was something that went to the force of the vehicle, is compare it to the number of Glock pistols that you'd have to simultaneously fire to get the same kind of force, which killed somebody and permanently maimed another passenger.
Isn't it unduly sensationalizing, though, the issue? Everybody knows what a Glock pistol can do. Major League Baseball player can throw a ball at over 100 miles an hour, yet that wasn't used as an example. Instead, it just happens to be a deadly weapon in a lot of them.
But that's where this officer's expertise is. He's not a baseball player or football player. He doesn't have expertise in those areas.
Well, just told me he didn't know.
He does work. Well, he works with kinetic energy, and I see where you're going with that.
I thought you said he got it from another trooper.
The last four pages of this came from another trooper on Wikipedia. And those things dealt with the baseball player and the football player and that kind of thing. When they were talking on cross-examination during Crozier's testimony, the defense said, so this could be like a baseball, or it could be a cup, or it could be something else. All things, meaning have this kinetic energy associated with them. But the football player and those kinds of examples didn't come in to the record when he was testifying. He was just talking about what he knew best, where he was proficient, which was weapons. And let's face it, the statute says it's a dangerous weapon. It goes to the force of that car.
Did the court do a balancing test with this Glock testimony, probative, prejudicial, to say that it was more probative than prejudicial?
The magic words, probative and prejudicial.
Magic words or whatever you want to call it.
She used the word comparison tool. She listened to Crozier took the stand. They stopped the testimony. They went into an extensive in-chambers hearing where the defense essentially voir dired Crozier. It went through everything. It's like a mini Daubert. Well, actually, it probably was a full Daubert hearing in a sense. And then she came out of the hearing. She said, let me think about it. She came out and she said she thought it was a comparison tool. So I think inherently she balanced the probative and the prejudicial effect. And what we're looking for is unfair prejudice. All the evidence that goes in is prejudicial to the defense, as this court has said many times. But what we're looking for is something that is unfairly prejudicial. And the state would submit that that's not the case here.
Back to Justice Severson's question. I didn't hear any answer to it. Where exactly did Crozier get the muzzle velocity of a 40 caliber Glock handgun from?
I guess my reading of the record is he got it from the from these kinetic formulas that he himself got from the police manual, that he didn't carry that around in his head, and then he would plug in the formulas from Wikipedia.
Well, is the foot per second number in a document or something we can read?
It's a formula that tells you how fast you're moving in terms of.
I understand the formula, but the feet per second at the muzzle, that's what's critical here. Where did that come from? Where is that number in the record?
I guess my argument would be it came from his experience in the accident reconstruction field, from the people he consulted, and from this.
Did he say he knew that number in his head?
He didn't have that. I don't think he had that precise number in his head, and I could be wrong. I think there were two different times he was talking about what he was carrying in his head. There is a formula, which is, speed times weight divided by a constant. That would be something that he had one that was very workable and he knew right off the top of his head. And I'm thinking that he had to pull the muzzle energy one off of the information that was in the manual. That's what I'm my interpretation of the record. I hope that answers your question.
So is that State's Exhibit 1 or Court's Exhibit 1? It's got four pages from Wikipedia at the back. And what are the first pages?
The first pages are what the officer got from the manual from the Police Institute in the University of Florida, which is where he had, you know, taken his training and where he had people that he consulted with. That's how my reading of it is, and I think that the exhibit is even marked at the bottom for the last four pages when it starts to go into the area of Wikipedia.
So those first four pages contain the numbers that he used, the 484 feet per second?
I think it's nine pages long, and so it would be the first five pages were from what the officer was researching. And he had the manual, and he had his formulas in front of him when he was testifying. And then the last four are designated Wikipedia on the bottom. And those came from this other officer who went and tried to help him and pulled this stuff off of Wikipedia for him. And that's how I read the exhibit. And again, this is not the actual exhibit. It's just a copy that I kept. So I hope that helps. And with respect to the first issue, the state's position is that it's moot. And if you are acquitted of charges, that means that the defense has prevailed. And it means that she won. She was not convicted on the first two counts of the indictment. Therefore, if you want to talk about a nonsensical argument, the nonsensical argument here is that there be some kind of prejudice or due process argument on these first two counts because this defendant was not convicted on those counts. Then the court also, when she was trying to put together what solution to do with this old case, State v. Bacon from 1979, and with these statutes that we have on first-degree manslaughter that deal with, which came down in 2005, she looked at it, she put it together, and she said, what I'm going to do is submit this to the jury, and if there's a problem, and you don't have a third-time DWI, and keep in mind, we already have testimony in the record from Officer Mayer that when he was doing his report, he was writing her up for a third DWI. If that doesn't turn out to be true, there's something wrong with the habitual offender, then what I'm going to do is I will vacate or dismiss those counts.
But so, the jury had to find her guilty, didn't it? I mean, the jury would have to say that the essential element of proving she committed a felony had been proved beyond a reasonable doubt. But there was no evidence that she committed a felony.
But actually, that's a really good question, because she was astute enough to realize that and to say, the statute says that you have committed a felony for first-degree manslaughter that isn't in this other statute, and that you were in the process of committing that felony. You were on your third DWI, and it was consummated when you killed this person. And
well,
you
can see
had
how
this accident.
I can see your process, how that works. I understand that. But We're talking about the jury. The jury goes back with the instructions and says an essential element is that this defendant was in the process of committing a felony. How can they find that? How can they possibly find her guilty of committing a felony when they have no idea what the felony is?
Well, in actuality, they didn't. They found her guilty of another count in our manslaughter statute. They found her guilty of subsection 3. But the court, when they asked the questions, she did what was the normal procedure. She said, I've talked to the defense. I've talked to the state. I want to hear from the defense again. The defense did not raise any objection, and she said, look at the instructions as a whole. And so the jury sorted that out. We don't try to guess what they were thinking. We don't try to say, well, this must have been inadequate for them. And we know that they came up with a conviction on the third element of our manslaughter statute. So in this case, it's moot.
But if it's not, what about, was there spillover prejudice because prior DUIs are in front of the jury?
If it would come up again, you're speaking of?
No. In this case, did the jury consider her priors in resolving the two charges she was acquitted of?
Oh, and on the part two, the habitual? Whether this would somehow come over to that proceeding? Is that what you're saying?
No.
I'm sorry.
I think the defense argument is that even though she was acquitted on those first two counts, There was some spillover prejudice because the jury had to consider that she had prior convictions as they were contemplating that. So
since they didn't get that far, I guess that's pure speculation on the defense's part. Whether that could happen, I thought that, in all honesty, that Judge Howman reached a very reasonable resolution when she was faced with this so that it wouldn't be prejudicial and that she was trying to do the right thing for both sides and hit a balance.
Well, do you agree that it's common knowledge that you have to have priors in order to have a felony DUI, as the defense urges us?
You know, I've thought about that, and I don't agree. My mother wouldn't know that. I have to tell you, I don't think the average person on the street does understand. If you've been through the criminal system, you might, and you've had some kind of DWI. But no, I don't think that your average person is going to understand the process that you go through for a DWI prosecution. All this, which I've always thought was difficult, the .08, the DWI. I mean, we have kind of a complicated DWI and enhancement procedure. When I was looking at the other cases from the other states, they were dealing primarily with, in this issue, they were dealing with felony murder and also with second-degree murder, but I didn't see anyone else mention the bifurcated habitual offender approach that we have. So, you know, she took what we had on the books in terms of case law that this court had handed down. She took the statutes, which are much later, and I thought she fashioned a very good resolution and a very intelligent one on this record. If there are no further questions,
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. All right. Ms. Laughlin, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. As we've been here this morning, there's been lots of questions and lots of talk just where exactly does this 40 caliber Glock handgun comparison come from? As appellate attorneys and appellate judges and clerks, we have the luxury of having a written record that we can go through over and over and over again. And I submit to you, if you do that, I have, it's still not clear where it comes from. Does it come from Wikipedia? Does it come from the training manual? Does it come from this other officer? Who puts this in the hands of Officer Crozier? We don't know. And
I thought you said earlier that it comes from Wikipedia, that it definitely came from the Wikipedia portion of that exhibit.
Well, I think that if you read through the record and you look at that colloquy between defense counsel and Officer Crozier, he definitely says that he got muzzle energy information off of Wikipedia. He does say that. And if you look at those Wikipedia sheets that are on the back of the court's exhibit number one, you will see in there many different types of firearms. I don't think that the 40 Glock specifically is listed in that Wikipedia, but then we have that number pulled out and put into this sheet that they say is from a training manual. It looks like a type sheet to me that anyone could type. I don't know where it comes from.
What, again, though, was that ever challenged by defense counsel that this is not reliable data? Because if it was a challenge, then don't we move beyond that to the issue of whether or not it was the balancing test of the probative value and the prejudicial effect?
The defense counsel definitely challenged it, Your Honor. The defense counsel raised the issue that it had no viable foundation, that it was unreliable. And the trial court's the gatekeeper here. The trial court has a duty to make sure that only reliable information is reaching the jury. The point that I'm making is that even if the court finds that it doesn't come from Wikipedia, which I still think that if you look at the numbers and you look at the court's exhibit, that's a fair guess of where it comes from, then we can't figure it out. The point is, why, if all of us on review can't figure it out, why is it getting to the jury? Why is this comparison coming to the jury if we don't know at this point still where it comes from, if it's reliable? Judge Hellman found that it was, again, clearly articulated basis, and that's not the standard. We have here the trial court not following the standard, not only there, but with the probative versus prejudice. And appellee's correct. And a lot of prejudice comes in against the defendant. That's the nature of our cases. But what we are talking about here is unfair prejudice. And that comparison was unfair, and it was sensational, and the only purpose was to persuade by illegitimate means here. And that's exactly what happened. You know, there was other clearly prejudicial information that was not given to the jury in this case, and we know why stuff like that isn't given to the jury. You know, in this case, it just so happened that the victim's family showed up at the scene, and that's all caught on video. It's very powerful video to hear this family being told by the officer on the scene, yes, that's your son, he is deceased, I am so sorry. It's gut-wrenching. Would it be evidence against Ms. Kvasnica? Did it happen there? You bet it happened there. Is it reliable? Yep, it's on the officer's tape. Why don't we let it in? Because it's not fair to Ms. Kvasnica. It's not fair to her, and it wasn't fair to her to allow this completely prejudicial comparison between 902 handguns being fired at the victims in this case to come in before the jury. And that's why we're asking this court to reverse and remand, because she deserves a fair trial. Like I said, defense counsel in this case had a tough job. He wasn't coming in saying, my client's innocent. He came in saying, this is the statute. We have a statute. It's called vehicular homicide. These are the elements of it, and these are the elements that have been met. This other statute, manslaughter in the first degree, second degree, or manslaughter first, charges 1, 2, and 3, it doesn't fit those. So we'd ask the court again to reverse and remand on that basis. Do you have any further questions for me, Your Honor?
I guess not. Thank you, counsel.
All right. Thank you.